You're listening to Start Writing, where we explore the great minds behind the greatest stories. Hosted by Joseph Bendosky, author of the Skyfall series, and Jay Washburn, author of the Star Child space opera. Hello, this is Jay Washburn, and welcome to another episode of the Start Writing Podcast. Today, I'm very excited about our guest. His name is Rob McGregor. He wrote the novelization of Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, and we discuss some of the things that he added to that story that make it better. He also wrote 6 original Indiana Jones novels, which he wrote at a breakneck speed at 4 months apiece. He tells a funny story about 2 Indiana Jones fans who were pestering him and the wild outcome of that encounter. We discuss how he had an influence on the creation of the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles, yet never got credit. He tells us how George Lucas sent him instructions on what he was allowed to write when he was writing these novels. And he tells a funny story about how he had to fight Disney to get his royalty rights once they purchased Lucasfilm. He also talks about the vision quest that Indy has in those novels and where that was inspired from. And finally, he's written some significant nonfiction about the paranormal. These are true life stories that go everywhere from alien encounters to contacting the dead. And incidentally, he hosts a podcast about these topics called The Mystical Underground. And it's kind of an understatement to say that he is an expert in the paranormal. So without further ado, I hope you enjoy this interview with Rob McGregor.
Well, good morning, Rob. How's your day going?
Pretty good, yeah.
What's a typical morning like, or what you been up to?
Well, typical morning is I like to work early, get up 6-7 o'clock and get to work. And where my wife, Trish, she likes to work late till 1 o'clock. But by like 11 o'clock, man, I things start blurring and it's difficult for me to work late unless I'm really hot on something, you know, and it's plugged in. Then, you know, I can keep going later. But usually by 11, I'm done.
And that's why you scheduled our appointment right now, because you basically finished your work day. Is that right?
Well, I didn't finish my work day. No, I keep going. I have been working this morning, yes, but okay. You know, I don't you know, sit around all day drinking beer or anything.
Yeah. Well, do you mind if I ask what have you been working on?
Okay, like right now, I'm adapting a movie script into a novel, and that's been going pretty well. But you know, last night I get a email from the writer, and he says, "Well, by April 24th, you're supposed to have 175 pages to me." And yeah, you know, I realized He must be mistaken, because first of all, he said this is what we agreed to. First of all, I don't work on pages. I work on numbers, and so there was some confusion there anyhow, because that would have required me to be like 3/4 of the script done, and I just started 3 weeks ago. So we talked about it, and you know, it got it straightened out, but. That's, you know, something that happens with, you know, working with somebody else and on their books. Yeah.
Well, so can I ask, I mean, I'm assuming that's a secret. Can you not tell us the title of what you're working on?
I guess I could tell you the title. It's called Simon, Son of Star.
Cool.
It's a historical, novel and a script, that goes back to the 1st century AD in Israel.
Oh, wow. That sounds interesting.
And it starts in the present with the discovery of a coin. And then we find out the history of the coin, and then we go back in time.
Dang, that sounds like an exciting adventure.
Yeah, it's a basically it's about a rebellion of the Jews against the Roman, had turned Israel into one of their provinces.
Yeah, dang, that's but interesting. Yeah, that sounds really cool. Okay, so I like to start my interviews with I want to ask about your name and if there's a story about your name. Some people talk about the etymology of their name. Some people talk about who they're named after, but tell us the story of your name.
Well, my full name is Robert Roy McGregor, and I'm named after a Scottish hero, Rob Roy McGregor. And he was something of a renegade and at a time that the Scottish were rebelling, and the McGregors were labeled as cattle thieves because they had an insurance policy that they provided other ranchers, and if you didn't pay the insurance, you were your cattle disappeared. So they're kind of crooks, I guess, criminal operation. And so the King of England went after them, and there was rebellion, and a lot of the name McGregor was abolished for like 150 years. Nobody could use that name, and a lot of them took on the name Campbell. And I mean, they didn't mess around with the McGregors. They drove them off the highlands. Drove some to the coast to become fishermen, which they've never lived in the coast, never fished before, so that was difficult. And others, they basically made sent to Jamaica and made either slaves or having 7 years of servitude. That's why you probably never noticed it, but being a McGregor, there's a lot of McGregors on Jamaica, and they've all been blended in with the local population over the centuries. So.
Dang, that's cool.
I have like probably 75, 80 Facebook friends who are Black McGregors.
Dang, that's really cool.
So that's the story of the name.
Awesome. Thank you. If you were a character in a novel, what is a quirky trait about your personality or your writing process that would make you memorable?
Oh, that's a good question. But my quirky trait, that's a good question. I can't think of anything right offhand that I do something that would be somewhat quirky.
That's okay. We can circle back to it, or I know that you're currently writing with Trish often, like you guys collab. Tell me how you met her.
I met Trish when I was working as a journalist, a newspaper reporter for the Hollywood Sun-Tattler, which is Hollywood, Florida, not California. And
about how old were you?
I was, I guess, 32 or, about 32, 33. Trish, the same age. And she was teaching at Florida International University, a program they had to teach English as a second language to Cuban refugees who had come in the Mario boat lift from Cuba, when I think about 100,000 Cubans flooded into Florida. And this was like 2-3 years after that. And my editor said, well, are these people just becoming part of the Miami Cuban culture? Or are they learning English? So I found somebody who was teaching English to Cuban refugees. And we talked afterwards, and we found out we had some common interests. And so we got together, and it turned out that, what I was doing at that time was trying to get out of journalism, trying to become, not getting out of journalism, but being out of working for this particular newspaper and becoming a freelance writer. And so I was doing some magazine writing on the side. And meanwhile, Trish had just finished her sixth unpublished novel. So she said, "Well, you read it for me." And I read it, and I edited it, and I suggested changes, and she agreed and rewrote it, and it sold. It was the 26th submission to a major publisher in New York, and that at the time there were a lot more variety of publishers available than there are now in the mainstream publishing, and it sold. And shortly after that, I got a project to write a nonfiction book for a CEO in Washington, D.C., and we both quit our jobs, and that was like fall of 84, and we've been at it ever since as freelancers.
Yeah, dang, that's so cool. So you invented a character, Jack Shannon, who's Indiana Jones' roommate in college and then their buddies afterward. I wanted to ask you, who's the real life Jack Shannon? Can you tell us about your buddy on your adventures?
Well, there's a couple of guys I knew from Minneapolis where I grew up, Jeff and Jay, and that character is kind of a combination. In fact, I think I dedicated one of the novels to those guys, and they're musicians, and we spent a lot of time in running around in the music scene late at night in those days when I was young, and so that's where that came from.
Dang, that's super cool.
Yeah.
Paint the scene for us of the first time that you watched Indiana Jones.
Ah, boy, the first time I watched Indiana Jones, I guess that would be Raiders of the Lost Ark, but I can't remember. Can't remember seeing it. I'm sure it was in the theater and not on a movie screen, but I was fascinated by the story, and because my background, I had gone to college with the interest of becoming an archaeologist. In fact, in ninth grade, we had to give a report of what we wanted to do for careers, and I was the only one in my school that wanted to be an archaeologist. And so that was what I set off to be in college, and I took anthropology classes. And but along the third year or so, I took a journalism class, and I realized, well, this is something I get out of college, and I can get a job and get working and making money, because I didn't have much, and it was going to be a lot of extra years of study to become an archaeologist. And at the time, there were probably less than 1,000 archaeologists, working archaeologists in the world. And you have that many journalists, and in 2-3 newspapers or a few newspapers. And so I switched to becoming a journalist, which I did. And what I would do, though, is I still had an interest in the ancient world and ruins. And so I would have a job for a year, year and a half, saving my money. I would quit and take off to Mexico, Central America, South America, Europe, North Africa. And I always end up archaeological sites at the ruins, because that's what interested me, even though I wasn't pursuing it professionally. And so little did I know, this was all good research for what I would do when Indiana Jones came along. So,
that's crazy.
I would run out of money and go back and find another newspaper job and start over again.
Yeah. Dang, that sounds so exciting. So how did you get picked to be the writer to create the novelization of Last Crusade?
That was something that was just fell into my lap. I was very fortunate that I had done a favor for an editor, and she rewarded me by sending me the script of Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, and asked me if I would adapt it into a novel. And what happened is I had been writing another novel, actually two or three novels that were based on a television series that was started by Anthony Yerkovich, who had been the producer of Miami Vice, and this was supposed to be a hot new detective series, and it was a big flop. And this, by the time my books came out, there was no television series to relate to. But anyhow, I'd done two of them, and then the editor said, "Okay, we have another one, but the writer has dropped out, and we need this quickly. And can you get it to me in a month or 5 weeks or something?" And I said, "I'll try." And I did. And after that, she said, "Okay, would you like to do this Indiana Jones novelization?" So,
dang. What's it like transitioning from silver screen to novel? And most of our listeners are authors themselves or aspiring authors. Mm-hmm. And so maybe talk about the advantages that the medium of a novel has over the silver screen.
Well, of course, you can get into the head of the characters that you can't do with a movie. And the perspective, and with novel writing, it's perspective, where in movies, basically, the perspective comes from the camera. I mean, you have main characters in that, but the camera will go off the main character and show opening scenes that don't have any character perspective at all. And so it's a different style of writing. And like the one I'm doing right now, it's one of the characters is Emperor Hadrian of Rome in the first century. And so I have his perspective, and then I go to other characters, and where in the script, it's very slender material on Hadrian, and I had to do a lot of research and actually create one new character so far to give him somebody to talk to, because you can't just have a character and without anybody to talk to, and
yeah,
he's totally in his head. So yeah, that sort of thing.
Huh. Dang, that's really interesting. So I read your Last Crusade novelization, and I noticed that there's a section where it talks about, I think, six beasts that are part of the Grail legend. And then I also noticed another passage, and I'll read it. But I'm wondering if you wrote this or if this was part of the script, but it was cut. So Indiana Jones's dad says, "Marcus, we're like the four heroes of the Grail legend. You're Percival, the holy innocent. Sala is Bors, the ordinary man. My son is Galahad, the valiant knight, and his father is the old crusader, Lancelot, who was turned away because he was unworthy, as perhaps I am. Then he turned to Indy, but remember, it was Galahad who succeeded where his father failed." I just thought that was such a cool passage, because I kind of know about, you know, Grail lore and stuff, and it was more integrated. Is that something that was just taken from the script, or is that you? Or
That wasn't in the script. I put that in there. The mythical stuff about the young Indy when he was on a quest in the desert as well. That was all new stuff that wasn't yet. So what happened was they gave me a script that I think was 112 pages, and I had to write about a 300-page novel from that. So at first I go through and I write it close to the script, embellishing on the characters and their thought process, of course, and interactions. And then the second time I add characters, if necessary, and scenes, mm-hmm. like I did with the young, and in order to reach the total word count and for the novel. But so when I saw the movie, I was shocked, because not only did, of course, the scenes that I added weren't there, but also some of the scenes from the script were not there, then been cut down. So to me, it went really fast, and there was like so much missing, you know. And I thought, well, I looked around, is anybody going to like this movie? it ended up going over quite well, but there was a lot more to the story.
Yeah. Yeah. Dang, that's super cool. So when you were writing, what kind of timeline? I guess I'm wondering. Did you get to come in? Did you get to see some sets and props, or they just give you the script and said, "Here you go," and that's all you had? What was that like?
They sent some photos of characters along to work with, but, you know, I wasn't on the set or anything like that. But they did throw me for a loop at one point during the writing, and I got a call that said, okay, remove all references to Turkey. The government of Turkey has gone to the American consul and has requested that Indiana Jones not appear in Turkey, that Turkey is not in that movie. And so, and I said, oh, wait a minute, about almost about one third of the book is takes place in Turkey. But ironically or interestingly, that what happened is I did some research and found out that in 1946 through 48, I think it was, not sure exact dates, but the same time when the movie was taking place, the Turkey had a different name. And so I was just able to change the name. I can't think of the name right now, but
I think it's Hatay or
Hatay. That's it. Yeah. Hatay. I just changed it to Hatay and then I got away with that, you know, so, and nobody complained.
So dang, that's cool. Yeah. Well, I think there's a brief reference now to Hatay in the movie, if I remember right. But
really,
yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah,
cool.
Yeah.
Let's see. Okay. How about this one? So I'm a big fan of titles, and I noticed that you titled all your chapters in The Last Crusade. Is there a reason that you like to do that?
No particular reason. I think it just enhances the story when you have a title on it, and it, you know, it's a little extra work, but of course the titles fit with the content of the chapter and try to make it interesting.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But, you know, it's a little more than, you know, just saying chapter 5 or chapter 6.
Yeah.
You know, and
well, which is what your predecessors did for the two movies that had come before. But I really, I like that you give titles because I just feel like it's a better reference point. But,
yeah.
Another thing is I noticed that you have double the number of chapters as your predecessors. So you broke it down into smaller chunks. And I was wondering if there's a strategy behind that.
Just following the script and seeing where there's breaks, it seemed natural to stop and, you know, move on to another chapter.
So to work. So for me as a reader, it seems to flow really fast because of that. Just you're churning through quickly.
Yeah.
Okay, let me ask you some questions. So that was, you did The Last Crusade, which is the movie, and then let me ask you about your 6 novels. So I understand that George Lucas told you that Indy shouldn't be swearing. Is that right? But
There's a novel called the Dirty Indy novel. I think might be a Genesis Deluge. I'm not sure what it is. Because there's a couple F-bombs in there that and the first edition, and then after that it was changed, and I was no longer told to include anything like that. So
yeah,
it's PG.
Wow, that's
PG rated.
Well, and did that instruction come from George Lucas, or what? Why did they want to change
it? It came from George Lucas. I mean, he gave me a lot of freedom to do, you know, to come up with the story ideas. Basically, he told me make it in the 1920s before the movies. Indy is just starting his career as a journalist or as an archaeologist. So that's what I did, and it goes all through the 20s, which was an interesting decade. So that helped enhance the story.
Yeah. Actually, maybe you kind of already answered this, but you had 4 months to write each of these novels, but Indy's going to Greece and Scotland and Brazil and Turkey and Arizona and Chile. Did you just already have all this research in your head because you traveled so much, or how did you do research in just 4 months?
Yeah. Part of it was from my experience. And I should say that before I did those and got into those novels, I was working as a travel writer too. So I wrote for it was called Birnbaum's Travel Guides to South America. I did Colombia and Venezuela and two, 3 years, and as well as just writing other travel articles for travel sections of daily newspapers and the Sunday newspapers. And those were a way of making a living, and I could also resell them, change a little bit and resell to other newspapers. And so that's and we're starting out, that's how we began. And we finally hooked into a Omni magazine, which is kind of a science magazine, and got in with an editor, and we're suddenly making 75 cents a word rather than 10 cents a word. So that helped us continue on. So it's just, watching for the opportunities, following them.
Yeah. So on the book covers, it shows Harrison Ford in his mid-30s. And then, like you said, he's in his early 20s in your books. And so as I was reading, my brain suddenly clicked, and I switched from Harrison Ford to Sean Patrick Flannery from the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles. So I'm imagining that character instead. Yeah. But was there a decision where you kind of had to decide, like, is this more for kids or more for a young adult audience instead of an adult audience?
This was came out as an adult audience, but it was obviously very popular as a young adult novel. I mean, so many people have contacted me over the years that say, "Hey, I read those in my teens, and I just found them in a box, and I reread them again. They're great novels. Thank you." I hear that quite a bit.
Yeah, they are great novels.
I was just traveling. Recently, I live in South Florida, and I went up to Blue Ridge, Georgia, and one of my Indiana Jones correspondents heard about that. And said, he lives in Georgia, and Warner Robins, and he said, "Is there any chance you could, on the way up or the way down, we could meet for lunch?" And so I made that lunch date with him and his wife, and that was fun. This is somebody I have talked to. In fact, him and his wife, I introduced the two of them. They are both great Indiana Jones fans, and because she was kind of bugging me all the time, and I thought, I'm going to turn her on to this guy who also is writes me all the time, and let them figure it out themselves, and they hit it off.
Oh, that's great.
So they were so happy to finally meet me, their Indiana Jones hero and the guy who brought them together. So that was
so
fun.
Cool. That's a great story. Would you tell our listeners the story about, you created a framing device which had an old Indiana Jones for your novels.
Oh, yeah. Right. So that's how I, my original plan was to start with a 92-year-old Indiana Jones. He's got a cane, he's got an eye patch, and he's got a little dog, and he's sitting there and reflecting on his past, and he starts telling a story as if he's talking to somebody, and then it goes into the novel. And then we see him at the end where the story concludes with the old Indy. And what happened is George said, "Nobody wants to see an old Indiana Jones, take that out." And so I did that, and that was fine. But then several years later, there's a television series called Young Indiana Jones. And it began with a old Indiana Jones in his 90s. He has a cane, an eye patch, and a little dog. And so I know where that came from. So I guess he changed his mind. But that's Hollywood, I mean, those things happen. I mean, I didn't get paid for, creating that character at all or anything. But that's just happy with what I was doing with the Indiana Jones series. It was a good opportunity, and I didn't complain or anything.
How did George tell you that? Did you have in-person meetings, or is this like a letter? Or
No, mostly it was through his chief assistant, the first person he hired when he started Lucasfilm. Her name was Autry Wilson. I can't think of that's her second or third name. I can't think of her first name right now. But she was my main person who relayed things from George to me.
Yeah.
And yeah, no way. I didn't sit around chatting with George. Although one time I was out there for a meeting, and I got invited to go out on his yacht in San Francisco Bay, and that was going to be fun. But that day, it poured rain, and they said this is the first day it's rained in 9 months, so it got canceled and didn't happen.
Oh, bummer! Dang. So I've actually been writing a bit about Indiana Jones and researching. So as I read your novels, I noticed that there are a bunch of things that are in the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles, but they were first in your novels. So like Indy attends the University of Chicago, he gets involved with Chicago jazz, he has a run-in with Al Capone, falls deeply in love and then loses the girl, goes up against the Bolsheviks. Are these from you, or did this come from the? I heard there's an Indiana Jones Bible that Lucasfilm keeps.
I did meet somebody whose job was the Bible, and he was very upset about one particular thing I had written because I had Indy get married in the second novel, Dance of the Giants, and then I knew that. That couldn't last, so she died in the third one. I can't think of the name that takes place in Brazil in the jungle.
The Seven Veils.
Seven Veils, right? Yeah, and so that wasn't part of the Bible that he had ever been married, and that they didn't want that because. One of the things I was told, they said, gave me very few directions for these novels. I mean, the plots are mine, but they said, George said, okay, you can't use any of the major characters from Raiders or any of the novels except for the museum director.
Marcus.
Marcus, yeah, I could use him, and that was about it. And because he wanted to save the relationship that began in Raiders of the Lost Ark to the end, which he did in the fourth novel, and they
So, well, I guess part of my question is, did you ever get any credit for? I guess kind of breaking the ground for Young Indiana Jones and the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles. I feel like you kind of set the stage.
Yeah, maybe so. But I watched the series and I liked it. It was pretty well done. It was very educational as well. And that was totally. They had access to, I basically signed away anything that they could use all that material any way they want. There's no credit involved that I did recognize some things.
Why did you write? So you wrote about three novels per year, which is just incredibly fast. Why was that?
Well, they wanted these novels come out one after another and gave me 4 month deadlines. And first of all, it started out very fast with the Last Crusade, where they gave me 2 months to write a bit. They said, but if you can get this if you can write this in 5 weeks, I'll give you a $2,500 bonus. I wrote it in 5 weeks.
dang, that's impressive.
The Last Crusade, yeah. And so then... That hit the New York Times bestseller list for a couple of weeks, 2-3 weeks, and so okay, let's go with some original novels that you can write, and so I got a contract for four of them, and they came out one after another, no publicity at all. They just kind of dropped out there. And so people kind of discovered them. What are these Indiana Jones novels? I've never heard about these. And, you know, they kind of became underground favorites for indie fans. But Lucasfilm, you know, their Star Wars novels got a lot of publicity, but mine never did. But they sold in, I think, 14, 15 different countries and different languages. And I was fortunate that my agent was very good and was able to get me royalties for the foreign rights and and royalties for these novels too, which I think the other authors that followed me never got any royalties at all. They got a strict payment for the book, and then they were done. So I'm still getting royalty checks. I finished writing those books in 1992, and every once in a while. But I had to really fight to get them from Disney, because once Disney took over from Lucasfilm, you know, the royalties stopped. But I knew the books were still selling, and so it was really difficult to. I spent years, trying to find somebody in Disney who could help me. And finally, I got led to a guy in the accounting department who was a big Indiana Jones fan. So he did all this research and went back and found out what the sales were and everything, and paid me up for like 4 or 5 years.
That's great. Yeah. Good for you.
Yeah. Huh. But I had to pursue it myself to get that.
Yeah. So again, our listeners are writers. Do you have any tips on how do you write something that fast? And I just want to make a comment too. I generally correlate speed with quality. And you know, as you write fast, the quality goes down, but I don't think that's the case with your novels. You wrote some really exciting and fun novels, and yet you did it fast. Do you have any tips on how to do that?
Yeah, when I look at those novels now, I open them, start reading them, I say, how did I do this? You know, I don't know how I did it at the time. You just get plugged in and go for it. I mean, I would finish one, and the next day I would start the next, you know. I would give them, like, a page and a half of outline or concept. And, you know, some of them they turned down. I think the one on, I was going to write one related to Crystal Skulls, they rejected that. And there's another one, Sword of Destiny, that became an Indiana Jones novel, but that was rejected when I put that idea out there too.
Oh, really? That's so interesting.
But other than that, they accepted most of my stories and just moved ahead. And you know, I guess I just got plugged in and I did another long novel called The Ghost Tribe, Peter Benchley's Amazon, which was another television series flop that was filmed in New Zealand. And it was about an airplane crash, and the survivors in the Amazon jungle come upon a tribe of white Indians who speak with English accents, old English accents. And they were from, they were Puritans that got blown off by a couple of hurricanes, blown off course and landed on the coast of South America. And because they were attacked, they worked their way down a river and inland, and they basically, became their own tribe. But they had one rule: there was no intermingling of races with the locals, so they had remained white. Anyhow, I was asked to write the prequel because this television series takes place in the present. So I wrote the story of how it happened, you know, going back. And
dang, cool.
That was kind of fun. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was one that was fast. And that was, I think, my longest book, probably over 100,000 words, I think, on that one. And probably wrote that in 3 months.
Dang. Yeah. That's crazy. Well, it's impressive. I'll say that. Okay. Let's talk about some of you write some nonfiction about, I'm going to call it, supernatural things.
Mm-hmm.
How did you first get into that as like a career Like, how, yeah, how did you first get into that sort of writing?
Okay, well, what happened is during the late 80s, early 90s, mid 90s, we were able to get novels published one after another and get contracts. And then things started drying up we wrote quite a few mysteries, and Trish especially wrote mysteries, and I wrote a series. And then suddenly the whole mystery genre dried up, and a lot of mystery writers just, you know, stopped writing. But this is how we were making our living. So we shifted to nonfiction. We've always had an interest in metaphysical matters and paranormal. Mm-hmm. And when we first met, our first book that we decided to do was a joint nonfiction book about synchronicity, unusual coincidences that take place in your life. But we didn't really know how to do it at the time, and that didn't go anywhere. So, but then we had already made the commitment to be writers, and just continued on, and that came back. And years later, that we wrote The Seven Secrets of Synchronicity, and Synchronicity and the Other Side, and two, three others related to that topic, and then branched into other areas as well.
So, I've been perusing some of your books. I didn't even know what synchronicity was until last week, and yeah, I'm okay. There it's meaningful coincidence.
Meaningful coincidence.
Really interesting.
Right.
That's the simplest way of describing it. What it means. Yeah.
You also said something about how it's non-causal, and I don't quite understand, why is it significant that it's non-causal?
Well, because let's take the example that I'm thinking of somebody that I knew in high school, and I go on the internet and the Facebook, and that person I just thought about has sent me a Facebook request, a friend request, which to me, that's a meaningful coincidence, because I hadn't thought about that person for quite a while, or years maybe, and there he or she was. But if I had reached out earlier, a couple of weeks earlier, and said, "Hey, I see your Facebook, you're on Facebook," or made some kind of contact, and then the person comes in. So that's causal, cause and effect. Mm-hmm. But the way that it happened, as I described it, it was non-causal. There was no reason for, I made no effort to contact that person. It came to me after I had thought about it. So it was a thought that manifested into a physical event.
Mm.
And you could call it telepathy. You could call it precognition. But synchronicity is a term that kind of enfolds all of those types of paranormal experiences. Yeah.
Yeah. Dang, that's interesting. So you talk a little bit about skeptics in your books, and mm-hmm. there's a certain stigma, and I think it's interesting because the Navy recently released footage about UFOs and what do they call them? UPAs, I think.
Yeah, UPAs. I think they're using that term now.
But they're trying to make it okay to talk about these so that we can figure it out more. But what are your thoughts on the stigma around paranormal and how it's kind of taboo, or you get shunned if you talk about that kind of stuff? Any thoughts
right.
on that?
Yeah. Well, that's, always been the case with, the paranormal or UFOs, people being called UFO nuts. There was definitely efforts of disinformation to attempt to keep people to shun people from exploring this these matters, both paranormal and UFOs. So that's why scientists have shied away from it, even though you'd think that this would be, an area of exploration. And those scientists who have gone there, were often paid the price for it, so others have avoided. But that's, it seems to be changing now. It's things are opening up more. Yeah, I mean, there's still plenty of crazy people that contact us, but there is an underlying reality that we believe that exists.
Well, hey, so let me ask you a follow up on that. How do you sort out the crazy people, like, or how do you notice them, or how do you have a answer for that still?
You know, sometimes it's very easy. Like, there is one person that just is constantly sending Trish and I both emails. He's just, it's very clear that he has mental issues, and, you know, try to straighten him out a bit as best we can, but he's right back into it again. You know, I mean, he doesn't have evidence for what he's saying, and it's basically his imagination, and he has difficulty separating reality from his imagination. And so that's you know, I even talked to his father, and he said, oh, he's off his meds, don't listen, don't answer him. So yeah, that happens.
So you've researched UFOs and abduction tales. When the Navy released our footage, did you have any additional insights on that maybe the general public doesn't know about?
I don't think, the Navy, the videos were impressive, but they just showed an object, and there's such more depth in the field beyond that. They don't mention where they came from or who's in there, if anybody. But of those particular objects, I don't have any more information about those stories than that that have been presented there. You know, other people have I know somebody who got involved with the organization that is doing UFO research, and there's people that are in government and the CIA involved in it, and now that he used to be very friendly and open, now he won't say a word about it, you know. So
wow, that's crazy.
Yeah. So there's stuff going on, definitely. Yeah.
So let me take it back to Indiana Jones briefly. The Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, some people criticized it because it was about aliens, but personally, I think that's a great MacGuffin. I think it fits great with Indiana Jones. If you were to write another draft of Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, are there any tweaks that you would make in that story?
It was the original script on that was much weirder than the way it came out, with the aliens were going to play a more prominent role, but Spielberg talked Lucas out of it to tone it down, but he still got that ending in there. And that movie has had a lot of criticisms, and as I mentioned, that lunch I had coming back from Blue Ridge, and those two people, the husband, he really liked it. He said he watched it twice the opening day, and he's watched it like seven times in the first month or something like that. But she said she watched it the midnight showing, the first showing, and she said when it ended, other times with Indiana Jones movies, people get up and cheer and clap, and she said you could hear a pin drop. People were disappointed. There's a certain identity to a character that fans relate to, and when the story goes out of bounds, that gives, they have a problem with that, and the appearance of the UFO caused that. And also my last Indiana Jones novel, where there is some interdimensional travel involved, they did not like that either. Yeah. That novel got some criticism.
Yeah, dang. Yeah, I'm sorry. That can be hard.
Yeah.
So this was interesting. I've been writing. So I decided to write an essay about where creators get their inspiration, and I titled it Stealing Indiana Jones. And it was kind of like the background of what predecessors came before Indiana Jones. But then my older brother was a big inspiration for, he's like who drew me into that. He passed away in 2020. So I'm writing this essay, and all of a sudden I start writing about my brother instead of Indiana Jones. And it's funny because I put in a moment, like we're at his funeral and I see a hawk floating on the wind. And then I wrote about some dreams that I had about him. And then I started reading your book about like how to interact with the dead. And I was just surprised after I just learned what synchronicity was, that all these touch points that you're talking about were in my essay. And I didn't know that it was even on a theme, really. It just kind of happened. But anyway, that's mostly a story, and I'm not sure I have a good question for you, but I just think it's interesting how that lined up so well. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Well, when there's great changes in people's lives, like births, marriages, divorces, and deaths, those are major points, and that's a time when they're going to offer these meaningful coincidences turn up and happen, and seeing there's just so many stories about the appearance of certain birds that were meaningful, like this one person had just collection of pictures and statues of cardinals, and after he died, the family just saw all these cardinals around the funeral or around the graveyard, and just things like that. It's astonishing. That and meaningful for the people, or other people just walking by with, oh, nice birds, and not meaningful to them at all. But in the context where they were living, it was very meaningful.
Yeah. Dang, that's cool.
Yeah.
Tell me how you and Trish collaborate when you're writing a novel. I've always thought it would be fun to write a collab novel. I never have. I'm sorry, I shouldn't say novel, but just a book generally.
Yeah, a book. I don't think we've ever tried a novel, because we have different approaches, and you think I'm fast. She's really fast. She used to never have outlines at all, and she would turn out 300 pages and say, oh, I don't like this, and throw it away and start over, and she'd only started like 3 weeks ago, she just stay up all night and writing like that, and I can't do that. But I guess she inspired me to be a faster writer, and because the way she works. I can't think. We've written nonfiction. We work on an outline and take different chapters, and then we exchange them and add things or edit. So it's easier with nonfiction, but fiction, it's a different matter.
Yeah.
And I'm doing it in a sense with the script writers, since they're giving me essentially an outline, and I have to, if I get one page of a script, I have to write like three pages for that script. And a lot of times the one page have camera directions on it, and the names of locations over and over, and things that I can't even use. So, it really is a matter of the script being an outline. And even worse than movie scripts are game stories.
Because you did Staff of Kings. Huh?
Yeah, Staff of Kings. That was a lot harder because you can't make it a game. It's not a game, and a novel is not a game. So there has to be a lot of changes. And I think people who have played that game and read the novel, they see, the continuum of the story and the locations, but there's a lot of new stuff in there that wasn't in the game.
Let me ask a question about that. So you recorded audio and released an audio version of that, of course, unofficially. And I'm curious, would you ever consider unofficially releasing the actual text, like a Word document or an EPUB?
It has just been released recently. In the last 2 weeks, there is a novel out that an Indiana Jones fan who is has did a lot of work on it and put it out and has a cover from an artist. And that is out now. You can find that Indiana Jones and the Staff of Kings ordered as a digital book. It's not in paper.
Dang, that's so cool. I had no idea. I'll have to go look that up. That's exciting. Okay, let me ask you a couple rapid-fire questions as we wrap up. And I imagine these will be short answers, but that's up to you. Someone on Reddit asked, which of your books would be your first pick to make into a movie?
That's interesting. I guess, and this is not so rapid. maybe the Staff of Kings, that would be an interesting one, or the one in the jungle in Brazil. That would be.
Yeah, Matt, I just have to say that I love your first trilogy is how I think of it. Cause you introduced Deidre in the first one and it develops into that third one. And I just feel like those fit together so well. So I'd be sad if it were only that one movie, because I want to see all three.
Right. Those three would be, it'd be good.
So I know you wrote a whole book about meditation. Just give us a short version of what is your daily meditation like?
Okay. I usually in the morning, actually very early in the morning. A lot of times I wake up for some reason at 4 o'clock in the morning and I meditate then. And the way I do it is I start focusing on my body. I start with my left foot and follow my ankle, shin, knee, thigh, and then I do the right leg, just focusing on body parts way up. And then I do go from my hands, left hand and the arm all the way to the shoulder and the right. And then I go from the crown of the head down the torso and right over the body. And it puts me into a meditative state and keeps me focused. And, I either fall asleep or I, meditate for a while with my mind fairly peaceful and calm. And, and rather than thinking thoughts, I watch the thoughts as they appear. Right. That's a trick. We have that ability not only to think our thoughts, but to be aware of what we're thinking. And that's part of meditation.
About how long does that process take?
I can do that, the body thing in about 5 minutes or so, usually. Sometimes I drift off and I start over again, and because I am in a altered state as I go into about, yet I am awake too. So it's an interesting experience. That's one part. And then during the day, sometimes, and it's quiet and no one's around, and I also will meditate and just relax. And just being aware of my thoughts, very important, because there's so much chaos in the world and conflict and division. And so rather than getting triggered and caught up in all of that, I just kind of watch that process and watch what my thoughts are and releasing them rather than going there, because from experience, it doesn't work out well in the end.
Dang, that's cool. I'm excited. So I haven't read that one yet, but I'm excited too.
Okay.
It's some cool
thing.
What is the premise of your Crystal Skull novel?
It's a reunion of two ancient crystal skulls. It's a story with a detective in Miami Beach who gets involved in this exploration, and that's essentially what it briefly what it's about. And it combines the South Beach scene with Crystal Skulls and mysticism.
Dang, that's cool.
And there is a follow up called
Your Favorite
Innocence too.
Oh,
I just mentioned there's a follow-up with with Nicholas Pierce called The Fifth Essence.
Dang, cool. Mm-hmm. What is your favorite game?
My favorite game. Maybe Words with Friends.
Oh, cool.
I play that every day.
It's a fun one.
Yeah, it is.
What is work
and life? And Wordo is another one.
Oh, you know, Wordo is related. Me too.
Yeah, right. Love yeah. Yeah. I haven't done it today yet.
Me neither. What does work life balance mean to you?
Work life balance. For me, because I work at home, they just blend in. I don't take any particular day off and say, okay, this is my day off. I know writers that do that and say, oh, it's Saturday, I don't work today. I work every day, but for me, it doesn't really feel like work, because the work is what I do in the yard and keeping things up on this property. As I get older, it gets harder. I have knee issues, and I had a knee replacement in February, but I'm doing real well from that. I'm glad I finally did it.
Dang, yeah. I'm glad to hear that it's going well.
Yeah.
Let's see. Did you already tell us what book you're working on right now?
Right, yeah. That's the adaption of a script of Son of Simon.
Yeah.
Son of Star, yeah.
What book are you going to read tonight?
What am I going to read tonight? I guess the one I'm reading right over here is called The 7.5 Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle.
Oh, that's cool.
It's an incredible book. It starts out like an Agatha Christie mystery, but it goes from there, and it all takes place in this house, but there's different times where people don't move from different times in the past and the present related to this house, and amazingly how he was able to do this and pull this off. And it's fascinating.
Dang, yeah, it sounds really interesting.
Yeah.
Who's an author that you look up to?
Who would I say? I like Peter Benchley, his novels, his books, and I've been rereading some of the Carlos Castaneda books that I read when I was younger, and they're interesting, and having a different approach. I look at them more as novels now, but I know something happened to that guy, but I'm not sure exactly what.
So I don't know about him. Just give us a brief overview or intro.
Okay, Carlos is somebody who met an old Indian, Yaqui Indian, who was able to take him. He was an anthropologist, and he met this Yaqui Indian who just blew his mind. Was able to take him into an alternate world and dimension, and where he met people, interacted with people, and some of them were also in this world. And moved between worlds, and that's what these stories are about. And he claimed it was nonfiction, and that this Don Juan is the name of the Indian who opened his brain and opened his mind and soul. But he became a very controversial figure in the anthropological world, and was pretty much shunned, but he also became a multimillionaire with his novels starting in the late 60s. They started coming out, you know, one after another.
Well, so that reminds me, you have that theme of the eagle vision quest that Indiana Jones has. Did that come from a personal story, or maybe it sounds like it might be partially inspired by this guy's novels?
Yeah, right. I've been interested in shamanism. That's what you would call a term that relates to what I was talking about with Carlos Castaneda with the vision quest. And that's all part of, there's a medicine wheel involved. And that's all shamanism. I've had an interest in that, and I was involved with an organization called the Four Winds Society for a while, and I went on vision quests with them for a couple of years back in the 90s.
Dang, that's cool. I
always had an interest in that.
Yeah. So that means you probably did have a similar thing to what Indiana Jones goes through.
Oh, yeah. I had one of these vision quests. Was just incredible. I had to climb this. I was with a group of about a dozen of people or so, and with a somebody who is leading us, he had us climb these rocks at night. This was in Canyon de Chelly, I believe.
I've been there.
Okay, yeah, and we had access to it actually. So because it's usually closed off except for the local people, and so we climbed up in these rocks individually, and it was about 25 degrees. I'm being from Florida. I'm freezing. And so we meditate. And so I go into this trance, and I see across from the valley that there are three Indians who are climbing along a ledge on a cliff. And I can see them very clearly. And the third one suddenly turns his head and stares at me and just shoots off that ledge right at me, coming right at my heart, and boom, I wake up. And that ended it. And that I was told by others that, well, he was trying to kill your ego, and you blocked him. You should have let him do it.
Wow.
Yeah, that was an interesting experience because it was so vivid and so real.
Yeah.
I can still see them. They had these headbands and, how they were dressed and everything in school.
And I'm trying to remember, is Canyon de Chelly where there's like a pillar. It's just this shaft going up in the middle of a canyon called Spider Rock.
Am I
in the right place?
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
Dang, that's cool.
Spider Woman. It's a myth related to.
Well, that's so cool that you have a connection. Did you say Navajo or Hopi? Who was leading that?
That wasn't related to either. The Four Winds Society, they're more associated with the Caro Indians, actually, of Peru, is where their guidance comes from. And but my own interests are the Hopi Indians. That's because of that experience I had there. I was told that, and everybody was told that, something is going to come out of this that's going to change your life in some way. And for me, it was four novels that I wrote that take place on the Hopi Indian Reservation. Prophecy Rock won the Edgar Allan Poe Award for Best Mystery of the Year.
Oh, dang, cool.
Prophecy Rock, yes. Hawk Moon was the follow-up one, and that was a finalist for the same award.
Mm. Dang, cool. I'll have to check this out. That's sweet.
Yeah.
Okay. What is the one book that has had the greatest impact on your life? This is my last question, by the way.
Okay. Greatest impact in my life. I can't really think of one particular book that, I'm not a religious person, so I'm not going to say the Bible.
Okay.
There's just been so many that have been meaningful for me that I can't think of any one that stands out over any of the others. So.
Okay.
I guess that's a bad answer, but
that's okay. So just to wrap up, I'll put a link to your podcast in the show notes. And I guess if people want to reach out to you, is there a particular place that they ought to reach out?
They can go to themysticalunderground.com.
Okay. Okay, that's excellent.
One word, themysticalunderground.com.
Okay. Yeah, I'll put a link to that in the show notes. Rob, I'd love to give you the final words. So, if you want to make an invitation to our listeners or an ask, or if you want to give advice or anything you'd like to say.
Trish and I have a podcast called The Mystical Underground, and it's available on all the major podcast platforms. You can just look it up, The Mystical Underground, and you can we explore the realms of paranormal and UFOs, and we have different authors come on and talk about their books, and it's a lot of fun. We enjoy it.
Okay, cool. Yeah, and I'll put a link to that too in the show notes. That sounds
okay.
Awesome.
Yeah, I guess one other thing I might say is for people who are starting out, it's different now for writers than when I started out. I mean, we started out, like I said, writing travel articles for newspapers, and those travel sections don't even exist anymore. And newspapers are, have shrunk way down, and everything's gone digital. And that's where the answer is for people starting out. There are jobs available for writers to start out writing blog posts where you can earn money, and you can write travel articles for my daughter does this. She makes $4,000 or $5,000 a month writing, working with projects that she's found on Indeed and Upwork, she does quite well. And she's starting out about the same time Trish and I started out as freelancers, and in some ways she's ahead of us, because she's making pretty good money. It's a combination of things that she does. So
I just wanted
to mention that. So if you think it's all the major publishers have kind of condensed and it's very hard to find an agent, you can spend months and months and not even get a response from agents, or just get some form response, and it's very depressing. Well, there's alternatives that you can pursue, and it's also very easy to self-publish now than it was in the past. You can do it virtually for free, and I just wanted to mention that too for writers.
Yeah, thank you so much. That's great advice and very helpful. Well, Rob, thank you so much. I appreciate chatting with you. It's been a real pleasure. I've loved everything that I've read from you, and I appreciate you taking some time.
Yeah, great. I appreciate it. It was fun.
Excellent. Okay. Well, and to our listeners, it's time to start writing. So there's the interview. I hope you enjoyed that. And now I'd love to just tell you a personal anecdote on why I selected him as a guest on the podcast. I have been writing a nonfiction piece called Stealing Indiana Jones. And as the title suggests, this is about where artists get their ideas. And so as I was researching Indiana Jones and what kind of predecessors inspired that story, I started reading Rob's books, Rob's Indiana Jones novels. And I was really curious to find out whether he had gotten credit for coming up with many of the ideas that later made it into George Lucas's Young Indiana Jones Chronicles. And that's why I asked him that question. I'd also love to just tell you the story of Stealing Indiana Jones. So I started with that premise that I just mentioned, but
as I got writing, I started writing about my boyhood and about my relationship with my older brother who passed away in 2020. And I started to realize that even though my intention as an author was to simply write about creative inspirations, but it turned out that I needed to write about my big brother and him passing away and how he died and how that has affected me. And so Stealing Indiana Jones became kind of this complicated weave. And the end result is something that I am absolutely proud of. I think it's one of the best things I've written. And I'll give you the pitch, the back cover blurb to listen to now. Stealing Indy will pique your intellect and break your heart. James Wolfhampton. In 1990, a 6-year-old boy stole something from his neighbors, a small book, the ultimate Indiana Jones treasure, a Grail diary. It promised everlasting life, but because it was stolen, the little boy didn't dare tell his older brother, his mentor, what he'd done. In 2020, 30 years later, that older brother passed away. Stealing Indiana Jones is the true story of these two boys and how they discover a monstrous secret that George Lucas stole his ideas for both Star Wars and Indiana Jones. As they struggle to make sense of what this horrifying truth means for all of us fans, they find redemption along the way. Their story explores inspiration and how great stories come to life. It examines, without shying away, disillusionment and innocence doomed to die. Their story is a salute to the loss of childhood and to the loss of life. Stealing Indiana Jones is a journey through the 90s, a glimpse of boyhood and fandom, and it's filled with both heartbreak and heroism. Most importantly, it's a quest to uncover the secret behind all great stories, the secret of immortality.
So that, my friends, is Stealing Indiana Jones. You can get it at stealingindy.jwashburn.com. You can purchase it on Kindle. There's also an audiobook on Audible. And finally, if you sign up for my monthly newsletter, I will send you a free copy of the ebook. And you can do that at theinformant.jwashburn.com. That's just the letter J, theinformant.jwashburn.com. Thank you for listening.